I follow a bit of Formula One. It's not big business, it's actually huge business. And I can't remember a time when an F1 driver who won thanked their pit crew as the first order of business in a post-race victory interview. But when that driver underperforms, the first words out of their mouths usually is how undrivable their car was that day. Which is what really is amazing about those sound clips of post-race Jessie Diggins thanking her tech team for the skis that got her the win. It never fails. Almost every time, it's the first thing she says. So why is she so emphatic about mentioning these faceless journeymen and journeywomen of the World Cup circuit as the first people to get kudos when she wins? This episode of Threshold is brought to you by Aaron's Co. As a family-owned manufacturer of outdoor power equipment, Aaron's Co. is celebrating 90 years of shaping landscapes around the world. At Aaron's Co., they love all things snow. With more than 4 million snow blowers produced since 1960, Aaron's is known as the king of snow and is the number one brand of two-stage snow blowers in the world. Their machines are passed down from generation to generation. Visit Aaron's, that's Aarens.com, to find a dealer near you. In about 1987, the world's largest ski wax manufacturer figured out that fluorocarbons made amazing lubricants for the bases of skis on snow surfaces, especially, and more dramatically, the warmer and wetter the snow became. It really changed the sport forever. Since then, fluorocarbons found their way into almost every single application of ski racing wax, regardless of temperature, because they made skis faster. Period. Even the grip waxes had them, because they'd free up the speed on the snow when the sticky wax needed better glide qualities as it slid over the snow. But a few years ago, amid the hubbub of COVID, the European Union banned these fluorocarbons from being produced anywhere, for any reason. Suddenly, ski racing had a problem. Almost every high-performing race wax in existence was now illegal by European Union law. The Fédération Internationale de Ski, or FIS for short, was essentially forced to change the rules of ski waxing. After 3 years of exhaustive research, aided significantly by the International Biathlon Union, FIS now has a testing protocol for skis that detects fluorocarbons. Set off that meter, and you're disqualified if you race on that ski. Needless to say, this was a big deal for ski racing. At the World Cup level, the ski wax structure and skis themselves have a pit crew that work together as a team and then individually for the athletes themselves on race day. In the melting pot of multi-language jargon on a World Cup circuit, they are referred to in English as servicemen, hinting at the gender imbalance still largely present in the sport's climate. On the US team, we call them techs, short for ski technicians, and they do come in both genders, by the way. And Team USA has been pushing an initiative in the FIS culture to improve gender equity in this very profession. In these early days of the fluorocarbon ban, the United States has flourished, reaching the podium every day so far this World Cup season, except for the very first day in which the women still were impressively 7th, 8th, and 9th. We at Threshold felt this was a compelling part of the sport, and the recent American successes on the World Cup felt like we needed to shed a little more light on it. So we connected with longtime US ski team tech, Chris Hecker, from Trondheim, Norway, where he'd just settled in preparation for the fourth stop of this World Cup season. Chris, welcome to Threshold.
Thanks, Chad.
Cool. Well, it's nice to have you here. It's nice to catch up with you. I want to start out for folks who don't know you. I want you to tell me a little bit. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came. Let's start here. Where are you? It's a nomadic life. We'll start with the present. Where are you right now? And where did you just come from?
Right now, we're in Trondheim, Norway, and we just came from a weekend of racing over in Östersund, Sweden.
It was a pretty awesome weekend of racing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's been a kind of surreal start to the ski season so far for us.
That's awesome. So let's go back to like kind of your background, like where you're from, how you like what led you to where you are today.
Sure. From Minneapolis, Minnesota. Went to kind of school in that area. Graduated from Anoka High School. Went on to St. Scholastica, where I had a great ski coach there, and Chad Salmela and Maria Stuber. Yeah. 4 years there, graduated. Thanks. And then ended up on the World Cup a year after graduating from Skalaska with Rec Ski Wax.
So how did you know, or let me put it another way, how did you feel, like, how did you get the job? Like, was it something you were kind of eyeing, or was it just an opportunity you kind of grabbed? Did you aspire to be a ski technician on the World Cup? You know, explain a little bit about how you became a World Cup ski technician.
Yeah, so after graduating school, Rex was losing one of their current World Cup wax techs to Solomon. His name was Tony Puntel. He's actually their head of biathlon service. And so they needed to fill in to help with their research and development program, as well as sailing on the World Cup, where we would travel from race to race. We'd essentially do 2 weeks with cross country, 2 weeks with biathlon, where we would be testing new products, testing current products, and then relaying what product information we have to the teams so that they could better use the Rec Ski Wax products on the World Cup. So that summer, I went over because they'd asked me if I would come for a 2 week stint in the ski tunnel for some testing and kind of product development side of things. They told me that it was just a trip that they needed some help with, and it ended up being a job interview without me knowing it. So once I got home a week later, they sat down and said, "Hey, we have an opening on the World Cup. We'd like you to come with us for a 3 month period." And then that started a 3.5 year job with Rec Ski Wax on the World Cup.
Cool. So then talk about that transition from how you went from Rec to the US ski team. Like, you know, when did that happen and how?
Yeah. So between Rec and the US ski team, I had some on and off stints with the US biathlon for about a year and a half of time. So I had some experience with teching for athletes and for team, as well as a product knowledge of Rec, and I knew a lot of the industry guys, so we would all kind of chat about all the kind of different new products on the World Cup between each other, and then that kind of opened the door for me with the U.S. team. I knew the team well. I knew how their dynamic worked. I had some prior experience with U.S. biathlon. So the 2020 was the year that we were supposed to have the World Cup in the U.S. And everything kind of got cut short. So that April, Chris Grover called me and asked if I would apply for the position that was opening on the team after that season, and I ended up on the World Cup with the U.S. ski team in 2020 in that fall.
So you get the job with the U.S. ski team. So, you know, I think a lot of the listeners of this podcast are active people. There's going to be a lot of people who know what ski wax is. They might even have heard of stone grinding and maybe structure, and might even understand flex of skis. But I'm going to guess that's a minority of the people who are maybe even tuning in right now. So let's assume we're all talking to folks beyond wave one of the Berkey, or maybe don't even ski race per se, but they like to ski. They like to watch skiing, and they know waxing skis is a thing, and that it's important. But what exactly do you and the colleagues you work with, and I'd like to get an idea of how many we're talking about in the process of a World Cup weekend, but what exactly do you do as a group, and why do you need so many of you, and why do you need a massive wax truck to do all that?
Yeah, so there are 7 full-time wax techs for the U.S. ski team throughout the winter. We have 8 total benches, so that means we always have a rotating wax tech, or we have the Trail to Gold fellows, which we can talk about in a little bit. But we have the 7 main or the core group of techs that are at nearly every race weekend. Occasionally we will miss one or two here or there, depending on if it's a skate weekend or a classic weekend. But essentially what we're doing is we're testing all the different products in the different applications to put ski wax on top of skis.
And so just expound on that just a little bit. Like, you know, what does it entail? What when you go out on a morning of the race, First of all, what skills do you need as a technician? And then, and what are the multiple things that you're doing for the athlete specifically? I know it's not just one layer of something. There's a multiple layer. So explain that a little bit. What skill do you need? Like, what makes a good wax technician? And what are the things you're looking for that athlete to have the very best skis and world-class competitive skis on that race day?
Sure. I think a lot of it is for our team. And I think one of the things we do that we do really well is that everyone keeps an open mind. Even if the conditions say it's blue skiing and you're picking out all your blue waxes, you still got to keep an open mind because sometimes a red wax could work or a green wax can work. And so that we collectively say, hey, I've had this type of wax and this product work in these conditions before. Might not work for it, but you have a couple of safe options and a couple of kind of like volatile waxes that could be really good or they could be really bad. Essentially, on race day, we show up about 4.5 hours before the race. Mm-hmm. We start by prepping athlete skis for the race. So we will take our anywhere between 4 to 8 pairs of skis on race day. We'll get those ready for testing. And then we will move on.
That's per athlete, the 4 to 6 pair of skis per athlete, correct?
Per athlete.
Right, yeah. Right. Okay.
So we have 8 women and 6 men start. So we have 14 athletes on a given day to prep skis for. And then after we prep our athlete skis, so each full-time tech is in charge of anywhere between 2 and 4 athletes on a given day. I personally wax for Kevin Bolger, Novi McCabe, Scott Patterson. So distance skiing is Scott and Novi. Sprint skiing is Kevin and Novi for this first period. Mm-hmm. Once we're done with prepping athlete skis, then we'll move on to test skis. We have 5 sets of 8 in the truck that we will apply different products to, or series of products to each fleet. So sometimes it's just the specific product, sometimes it's specific liquid, sometimes it's just application of one product, and we'll use different methods in order to see which way of applying it to the ski is going to be faster, because not just one scraping and brushing is going to work versus like more than another thing. So we'll test anywhere between 4 and 8 different ways to apply the same wax. So we'll try to get down to the even minute details of this wax was good. Now what's the best way to apply it?
Okay, so then you get the wax. So you come up with a wax plan. You have that. And the athlete skis that you've prepped are sitting back at the truck. At some point, you have to make a decision, correct? Like this is a drop-dead point on this decision of what we're going to do with the race wax. Now you switch focus again. You go back to the athletes. The athlete starts showing up to the race. What do you do then?
Yeah, so we'll take out the athlete skis. Typically we'll have a window to bring it to, if we have bring out 8 skis, we don't want our athletes out there for 45 minutes just testing skis.
Right.
We want to make their life easy, so we will pre-test or we'll knock some skis out before they show up. Ideally, we have athletes show up 1 hour 15 before the race. That's a typical test and warm-up period. This year it has changed a little bit with the floral free policy, so we need to have skis to the start 30 minutes before the start, whereas before we needed to just have it before the athletes start.
Right.
So that brings our timeline back a little bit.
Yeah, but we'll dig into that a little bit. We'll dig into that a little bit more in detail, cool. But keep going with the timeline. This is great.
Yeah, so we finish our test skis, we finish testing our test skis, and then 5 minutes after we're done doing product testing, we will be on snow with our athletes, narrowing down their ski fleet. Once we pick out their ski for the day, we'll run back to the truck and use that knowledge of product from the previous tests in the day and start applying it by underlayers, paraffin, toppings, a structure, and kind of compile everything together onto one ski for them to go race.
Okay. So I think that explains when you put the fact that you've got 14 athletes, 6 to 8 pairs of ski per athlete, you start really seeing really quickly how those numbers and the timeline you have to prepare for a World Cup race is really proliferated, and you need big staffs and you need space. and you need a truck. So that's kind of interesting. So, but this year, and you allude to it, this is what I want to kind of pick apart a little bit more, is how this year is different. On top of all this complicated processing of finding the fastest everything for the fastest application, you've all been using waxes containing different levels of fluorocarbon as parts of all the contents of all, pretty much all the waxes, pretty much your entire lives. I mean, me included. I remember, excuse me, I'm older. I remember when fluorocarbons came around. I remember Sara F coming out in like 1986 or 87. And since then, fluorocarbons have only found their way into more and more waxes, to the point where when I was coaching even over 8 years ago at St. Scholastica, almost everything we used had fluorocarbon in it to some extent. And that fluorocarbon made every one of those waxes probably better in most instances. So then you go back about 4 years ago, and the fluorocarbons are now illegal. The European Union basically banned the production of fluorocarbons, the very stuff that ski racing pretty much depends on across the board and everything you use. I mean, that's a tectonic shift in the products themselves at the very basis of levels to everything you do. And it's a wholesale change. And, you know, the big thing has been, how are they going to test it? Well, now they have testing, and now you guys are, the ban is on. You can't show up with a fluorocarbon on your ski. And tell us a little bit about how they're policing that and how it's changed how you're all doing your job.
Yeah, it's a huge shift for us. It's something that even in Ruka, we showed up early. We were prepping skis. It took a lot longer. And just the overall nervousness of submitting that first floral-free ski this year was nerve-wracking, because you don't know how well you've prepped for the season, how well you've cleaned the skis, how the manufacturers have cleaned their products, or the new test products that you're getting. There's just so many variables that if one of them is mistakenly contaminated with florals, then that's your entire team. And then you have this kind of asterisk next to it of a race, and say, mm-hmm. Hey, well, why were you guys trying to use florals? How did you use florals? Were you trying to burn powders in? Was mm-hmm. it a bad brush? Was it something that the manufacturer said? Nobody will ever know.
Right.
So just that first weekend, it was just, everyone was anxious.
That's scary. You could be labeled cheaters, you know?
Yeah. It's not something that we've ever even thought about doing, but there's so many things outside of our control with right now, because there is still circulation of florals within wax brands, and so it's nerve-wracking.
Right. It's kind of like having contaminated food supplements for doping. You know, it's like, is it going to show up and make you and label you a cheater? Which we've all seen, and I think we know where the U.S. staff stands on cheating. It's a pretty pretty outspoken about it. So that's great in painting just kind of the nerves of the whole thing. But at the same time, yeah, here we are 3 weeks in, and there is no doubt about it that this floral ban, at least for the first 3 weeks of the very first season, that the United States has a leg up on maybe even Norway. But it was really clear calling Östersund yesterday that even the Swedes on their home venue with snow falling in Östersund, that they didn't have the institutional knowledge they might have had with waxes and products when it was a floral year. And now they can't use those products, and there's a new, and it's a whole new batch of stuff. And the United States has been pretty consistently at the top of that game. So how are you guys, I mean, obviously you guys are psyched about it, but what do you think you're doing better than maybe the Norwegians and the Swedes on the skis right now?
Yeah, I do think that part of it is the teamwork of what we have going on in the wax truck, but also the athletes. I mean, you can't discredit how good our athletes are making us look as well. I think everyone's coming into the season in a good shape and a good place, and maybe we don't always have the fastest skis in the race, but our athletes make it look like we do, which helps immensely to this picture that's being painted right now in the first period.
Yeah, but
that
Chris,
being said,
okay, keep going. Yeah, I want to hear that.
I was going to say, that being said, we have had a lot of background work with industry.
Yeah.
So my background with those guys, I've had a lot of connections over the last 3-4 years. So we've been testing new products. We've been working developing products with several brands on the World Cup for kind of our own exclusivity until those products get to a kind of refined point, and then they'll bring it out to a mass marketing scale. So we have 3, 4, or 5 brands that we can currently work with that are producing products for us that we're testing. And that's been a huge key to our success, because I know that we've been racing on a lot of experimental stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that has, it has proven a difference so far in the first few weeks.
Well, that's great, because you were deferring it to the athletes, but you know, I'm calling a lot of the races, and Keek and I are sitting here watching it, and we see your handiwork working. So it's not like it's not going. Like we have an adept enough eye watching enough ski racing to know when the skis are good, and your skis have been really good. So I'm not gonna ask another question. I'm just gonna give you props on that one. So great job, and that's a big reason why, you know, Keek and I have been talking about it almost every time before the race, after the race, and we've been pretty impressed with your group's work as a whole. So great job. I'm gonna hit another aspect that I think is a really big one that a lot of people don't think about. And you all play different roles as technicians, but as I understand it, on race day, almost everyone has kind of their, like you said, their own wax tech. Like you work with Kevin on sprint days, you have Novi and Scott Patterson on distance days, and you help them decide on which skis they'll race on that day. Which you know, you're not their coach, but that's a pretty big responsibility emotionally. And you've done some coaching, and you know what coaching is all about. There's a lot of technical about that, but I'm fascinated at the psychological and the emotional roles that you play as a technician with the skiers you service individually. How does that relationship develop between the two of you, and how do you manage that relationship through the good times, which is relatively easy and fun through the good times, but on the bad days, it's also inevitably probably not very fun when it doesn't go well. So how do you see that developing, and how do you manage that relationship?
Yeah, it's a huge part of race day, especially for the athletes. I mean, we're one of the last people to talk with them and listen to what their kind of race thoughts are and race plan is before they go and tow the start line. So it's not just talking about which ski is going to work for that given day, but it's also just being kind of that listening ear, or that vocal box for them to bounce ideas off of while we're out skiing on course, which how to take the corners, how to take these uphills, how to take some of the downhills. We will focus on skis for 90% of it, but then there's that last 10% where they just want to have somebody to talk to and just get that race scenario, that race, their race thoughts into somebody else's head and just see what they think. And every one of us as wax techs have some sort of coaching or racing background. So they want to have, we build that trust up over several years worth of teching for them. And they just like to hear those thoughts, whether it's good, bad, or otherwise. It just gives them something to think about and another person to bounce some ideas off of.
Because of their love for snow, Aaron's has been a proud sponsor of the U.S. Biathlon team since 2019, and are proud to support the sports of biathlon and cross-country skiing with their new Aaron's Nordic Center in Brilliant, Wisconsin. Aaron's Nordic Center features 5 kilometers of lighted trails designed by Morton Trails, a state-of-the-art 20-point biathlon target system, and 3 kilometers of paved roller ski loop, and a robust snowmaking system with a 10 million gallon pond. Visit Aaron's Nordic, that's AAriensNordic.com to plan your visit. What are some of the key elements to a race day? I'm trying to put us as listeners into your shoes. What are some of the things you've learned are important in choosing the race day ski with that athlete? And what are some of the things that you know you need to avoid in that process?
For sure. So we do 2 types of glide work. You can either do it by glide outs, which would be holding each other, like basically gliding out a pair of skis would be going down a straight patch seeing who pulls away from the other by a certain distance, swapping pairs of skis and doing that same exact thing, going down the same patch, stopping and starting at the same spot to see which skis are faster. Just because a ski glides fast down a hill doesn't mean it's going to feel good climbing. So that's where ski flex and profile comes into effect. So when we look at race day skis, we will weed out the slow skis, take the fast ones, and then we'll bring them out and see how they feel. Because sometimes a fast ski doesn't feel good. Mm-hmm. And that can be one of the biggest traps for athletes. The other problem is if I'm picking out a ski for Novi, who is 40 pounds lighter than me, 45 mm-hmm. pounds lighter, what feels good for me might not feel good for her. So it's really listening to your athlete, but also giving them some direction on what you're noticing as well.
So that being said, you kind of allude to it, but I'm gonna be very explicit with it. So what makes a good World Cup ski technician? What talents do you need, both in personality and maybe even physiologically? Like, how do you know who feels a good ski? Like, how do you know somebody can feel a ski? I mean, you can't just put anybody on a ski and say, hey, you can be a wax technician. So there is that. I mean, there is a skill level and a talent level to it. What makes a good World Cup tech?
Yeah, paying attention to detail. I mean, every little feeling, every sensation, really focusing in on speed versus like kind of those different aspects of plowing versus glide versus static. There is a lot of detail, and you gotta be able to use those kind of learned traits from racing, from coaching, how your athlete skis, whether they're a light skier, a heavy skier, powerful, choppy, high tempo. You take everything into account and you pick out a ski for them that fits their technique, their style, and just how it feels underneath your foot and their foot. So it's a trust between the athlete listening to us as experienced techs for 5, 10, 15 years. I mean, we have guys that have been teching for 25 years. And so they build up a high amount of trust with new athletes because of their experience. And the new athletes can come in and just know that they're going to get the best service out of this staff and this team.
So one of the things I wanted to talk about, and you alluded to it a little bit earlier and said we can talk about it, and I think we should. I think that the gender equity of this sport, like any sport, it's very male oriented. The coaching side of it, I can say just from the coaching level, not even looking at technicians, but even the tech job has been very male slanted. A couple of great things that have happened, I think, in the U.S. team deserves some kudos for it, because they've really pushed the FIS to create a system in which that can change. So one of the things you said, you leave an open bench for the NNF Trail to Gold. So the Women's Ski Coaches Association in the United States worked with the National Nordic Foundation to create a stipend to send female coaches to the World Cup with the U.S. Ski Team. And you leave an open bench for that. Can you talk a little bit about how that is changing the tech culture? I mean, it's largely a male-dominated, profession, and that's changing. And the U.S. is really pivotal in doing that. And how is that? How do you think that's going? And just talk a little bit about those initiatives.
Yeah. So the Trail to Gold program, I truly think, is a huge part of why in the last 2-3 years our skis have gotten better and more consistent. So with FIS, we only have a certain amount of course bibs for people to go on course. So out of our team, you have 6 bibs. So if we have 8 starters, only 6 techs can go on course with their athlete. That being said, the women on our team, and women on any team, they get 2 extra course bibs, but they're women-specific, they're gender-specific. So I can't wear the women's bib and go out there and have a 7th course bib. So having female coaches that are experienced coming over here week in and week out has been a huge advantage for us, because we're one of the few nations that take advantage of bringing women in and having them ski with athletes for race day. So they're helping with the tech coach interaction. They're helping with glide outs for our skis. They're helping give non-floral racing information from us, because everyone in the U.S. has been racing non-florals for a few years. So picking their brains and seeing what they think has been a huge advantage for us as a country. And it has been one of the coolest programs as well to see all these new young coaches coming in and out of the truck, teaching us a lot more about coaching and teching, and hopefully contributing to their knowledge as well.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to point this out, that our Planet Threshold is to follow this conversation up with, and it might be even today, later today, or in the next couple of days, but I'm bringing Aaron Manning from Team Berkey and Minneapolis Ski Club, who has just spent 2 weeks with you all in the Trail to Gold scholarship program, and she's said great things about her experience. So we'll follow that up. That's why I wanted to ask that, and we'll get Aaron's perspective on the next threshold. So thanks for hitting that with me. But we're going to shift gears a little bit now. These first 3 weekends of World Cup racing, it's decidedly the best stretch of World Cup success, top to bottom, for U.S. ski team, maybe probably ever, between the men's and the women's programs, with the results that you've had. And a lot goes into that: the training history, the current fitness of the athletes, and then there's the equipment as well. So we know that these athletes can't win without great performing skis. I mean, just see Sweden in the 10K freestyle in Östersund. But if you could, put a percentage on it, what percentage of the ski selection and waxing process matters in the end result of the day? Like, what if you gave it a percentage, what do you think it is?
I mean, I would say you wouldn't be on the podium with just grabbing a pair of skis off the wall and putting
right
PS6 on there.
Right.
I think it's a huge part of the race day, but the athlete also needs to show up. So it works in conjunction. I would say if the athlete doesn't show up, we could make the best skis in the world. If we don't show up and we make horrible skis, doesn't matter how good of shape or how good the athlete feels, I don't think that they would be on the podium. I think the competition is too strong.
Right.
And to get slight advantages in skis or in athletes, it helps immensely.
Yeah.
And I think, like you said, you can see that this weekend with Sweden in the freestyle race.
Yeah. So you can't really put a percentage on it. Maybe percentage is a bad way to measure it, but
It's hard.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that we're both dependent on each other.
Yeah. That's a great way to put it. It's awesome. I think you answered the question very well. So the World Cup is coming to the United States in Minneapolis, and we're both from Minnesota. You're actually from Minneapolis. But the big thing that we've talked a lot about, people are kind of enamored with the idea of a wax truck, the wax trucks that travel around and follow the circuit. And you guys have one over in Europe that you put on the circuit, I think it's probably 7 or 8 years ago. But your wax truck, I believe, will stay in Europe during that World Cup, and so will probably everybody else's. So how do you and other teams make up for not having your trucks at the World Cups when you're not on the European continent? And how much work is that to abandon the truck for a few weeks and bring everything you need to the World Cups that are happening in North America?
It is a huge project. I mean, it takes days for us to pack, and it takes even longer to unpack. Mm-hmm. Going the few times that we've done it so far, so going to the Olympics in China, and we've done it a couple more times since then, but just physically packing, you don't know what the conditions are going to be like. Mm-hmm. So being able to fly home and to have Minneapolis as a World Cup venue, we have a huge advantage knowing that we'll have feet on the ground before any other country comes in with friends and family testing at Theodore Wirth days before we show up. So the packing time itself is going to be, it's a huge job. I mean, we're already going through logistics meetings to fly to Canmore and to fly to Minneapolis and then back. We've been in two meetings now, over 2 hours worth of just talking about what we need to pack. Mm-hmm. And then physically doing it as well, because trying to plan a week and a half and trust the forecasts that come out, you have to bring warm wax, warm skis, cold wax, medium skis, medium wax.
Yeah.
And then The other caveat is that none of our electronics work there because we have different outlets and different plugins
for Europe
versus USA and Canada. Yeah. So then we're bringing new irons and,
yeah.
and it's just, it is a huge undertaking, but it's going to be so much fun.
So I was going to ask you, so how much of that truck are you just going to leave in Europe? Like if you look at the contents of what's in that truck, do you take any of that stuff? Do you just start over with stuff that made in America and sitting in America? Or do you take like maybe half of it? What are you thinking? What would you guess is you're going to take from the truck and fly and send over to North America for that period?
Yeah. So this year we have a huge partnership with Swix. It's been an awesome sponsorship from those guys this year, and we will have them ship irons and wax and stuff up for us to Canmore, so we don't have to bring nearly as much equipment with us to that initial World Cup. But I would say that only 20% of what's in our wax truck will end up flying with us, mm-hmm. primarily being skis and wax. Everything else will stay behind. Our benches will stay behind. Ventilation will stay behind. All of our irons will stay behind. Essentially, we're just taking the most essential pieces that we can't replace, which would be our skis mm-hmm. and the ski wax, and bringing it with us.
Okay. So I'm gonna sort of now segue kind of into personal motivation. And I look at, I think if there's one thing, like, you know, I was a ski coach at the collegiate level, you know, because I used to be your coach, and I hated taking care of my skis as an athlete. Like, it was just a pain in the butt. Like, you just didn't, first of all, I was traveling with way less skis than the athletes are today. I mean, maybe I had 12 pairs of biathlete for an entire season, which is small compared to what you guys travel now. I mean, Jessie's got to have like 50 plus skis that she can pick through at least, and maybe not manage it all herself. But I mean, I just think like I figured more than 50, but even that, like even those 12 pair of skis are just the process. And we didn't have quite as many, you know, we had like three techs helping us when I was on the World Cup. But I hated that. And then as a college coach, I started realizing that I had to embrace what you do. And you know, as an athlete on my team that I did embrace it. I was robust about ski preparation. In a lot of ways, it's what burned me out as a college coach, the waxing itself, the actual ski prep. So, from my experience, I kind of want to ask you, you know, you are doing a relatively thankless, nomadic, extremely difficult job. And because even though it's massively rewarding, it's hard work, but why do you think you are doing, like, just intrinsically for yourself, just speaking for yourself, why are you there? Why are you doing this job? And why? And you've done it for what? 8 years now? 7 years?
Yeah, it's been since 2017. So it's been. I think this is my eighth year on the World Cup. Honestly, it's just seeing the joy, the accomplishments to the athletes. It's super fun to see, like this previous weekend, JC and Ben making a finals. That's why we do it. Mm-hmm. Those guys, when they come across, you could not wipe the smile off their face for days. I mean, it was just, that's what brings you back around. That's what, mm-hmm. that's what resets you for the next day.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, we can, that top 10 for Sophia, that smile was amazing. Yeah. That's why we go into every weekend trying and pushing as hard as we can so that every athlete on this team feels that way throughout the year. And it is a really fun team dynamic that we have. And it doesn't matter if you're first or if you're 30th, if that's a career best result, we want to embrace that as a team. And that's why we're here. It's super fun to see those developing athletes get better and better and better.
Well, right before I got on the podcast, I saw a picture of you with the whole crew. And anybody who watches these events after somebody wins, you saw the Germans do it when Victoria Carl got her first podium after 10 years on the World Cup. It finally got her first podium. The Germans had the same kind of reaction for her third place as you did for Jessie winning yesterday in that Östersund 10K. And I saw you front and center in that group and the smile on your face. And And it's the one thing about the job, even though I kind of quit coaching partially because I didn't like the waxing. It's the one thing I'm envious of for sure when I see those pictures, because I know what that must feel like. I've never been in that situation where I'm with a crew that won at the highest level. But it feels a little bit like an F1 crew when they win the F1 World Cup, when an F1 race. And that's got to be a huge payback for you.
Yeah, it's a surreal feeling.
Yeah.
When everyone gets together, because everyone knows it's not just one person in that team. It's not me. It's not Jason. It's not Matt. It's not Oleg, our head of service. Mm-hmm. It's everyone coming together and working on a strategy that works, and just having everyone come together for one athlete or two athletes for that win or for a third place or career best result is fun, and you got to celebrate it when you can.
Well, you've got a long season ahead of you, Chris. I'm really glad that you could sit down with us for these 40 minutes and discuss what you do. I think it's great insight, and it's a big part of what we're all witnessing right now with this historic run of success of the US ski team. Lots of luck to you and continued success to you, your crew, and the entire team. And we'll see you in Minneapolis.
Heck yeah, man. We're excited. Right. I think that's truly one of the most hyped up races right now is from anyone in Europe. Like, you talk to Norway, you talk to Sweden, you talk to Germany, and everyone's just so excited to come to the US for the first time in 20 years. And I hope that we can put on a good show for them.
Great. Well, you're doing a great job preparing for it. So, all right. I know it's getting late there. Get the sleep you need, because you probably got to get up and test in the morning. So thanks for joining us. Yeah. And really great to see you. And good luck in Trondheim this weekend.
Thanks, Chad.
All right. We'll see ya. Preparing skis to win a World Cup race has always been a bit of an arms race, in which resources to ensure success can largely be bought. The United States has historically had a reputation of doing very well with the relative resources they've had available. The fluorocarbon ban at least reduced the cost of the big picture, as fluorocarbon as a raw material application to the ski wax has been historically very expensive. For example, a vial of pure fluorocarbon for race wax is roughly $100 at wholesale for about 5 applications. If you do the math on what Chris talks about and how many skis they're waxing, that's a lot of money being burned into skis with fluorocarbons. At face value, though, the fluorocarbon ban stood as a universal good, in that while they were far from the largest concern environmentally in terms of volume used as ski waxes, they absolutely were not good for the environment nor the human beings interacting with them in such an application. Further, banning them stood to reduce the actual expense of success. But what we maybe didn't expect, and what we're seeing so far this season, is that, at least in the short run, the institutional knowledge of a completely new set of rules and products allowed to be used may have created a bit of vertigo among the teams who historically have the most resources to throw at the problem. That the US ski team is clearly succeeding in delivering some of the fastest skis so far this season certainly suggests that. So much so that the tables might turn on the program, as their success outruns their status as chaser to that of the ones being chased. In terms of Jesse Diggins and Rosie Brennan, that certainly is the current case. For me, I just love the parity that the situation has caused. It is indeed rare that a cost reduction in raw materials of top-level sporting success actually drops and you see an increase in the performance itself against the rest of the field. It's a nice little nugget that upsets the status quo and gives Chris Hecker and his colleagues a little shot in the arm and some very special moments to cherish, along with those of the athletes they serve. At least, for now. That's our show for this episode. I'm Chad Somla. Thanks for listening.